G'day, humans. I can't quite believe that I'd never met today's guest, John Safran. He's a legend of Australian broadcasting, but that gives him more gravitas and authority than he would probably want to have. He's been a troublemaker, a bête noire, a young upstart for nigh on 50 years now. Well, he's almost 50. I suppose his career isn't, but he's the sort of guy who exploded onto the scene in Australia in his mid-20s on a show in the 90s called Race Around the World, which I won't go into explaining because we talk about it in the interview. But this is a way of understanding where he sits. He's always been on the periphery. He's always been on the outside. He's always been lobbing hand grenades at the powerful in Australia and around the world. His new book is about a fascinating subject that I hadn't even heard about, which is the attempt by Philip Morris, the huge tobacco giant, to create a future beyond smoking for its tobacco products, and the kind of weaselly corporatist way that they're doing that, and the way that the public, including on the left, are so gullible when companies like Philip Morris do all the right things in terms of being politically correct and woke and being pro-LGBT at the same time as they're shoving tobacco down the throats of poor people, mostly people of colour, around the world. One way of getting an understanding of John is just to read the first few lines of his Wikipedia. I don't normally do this, but listen to this. John Michael Safran is an Australian radio personality, satirist, documentary maker and author known for combining humour with religious, political and ethnic issues. Safran's known for his television stunts, which include placing a fatwa on Australian television host Rove McManus. He was sort of like the Jay Leno of Australia. Sneaking 9 young men into an exclusive Melbourne nightclub by disguising them as members of the American band Slipknot. And running through Jerusalem wearing nothing but the beanie and scarf of the St Kilda Football Club. So, before there was Borat, before there was Ali G, there was John Safran on Australian television. He has a lot to say about a lot of things. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy this chaotic conversation with John Safran. You seem like someone whose life maps perfectly, as does mine, onto the rise of this thing we call the internet. What do you follow influencers? Are you a social media person?
I've had those companies. I think Cameo's the main one, but recently there's been another one called Memo, and they send me messages wanting me to sign with them in the capacity as an interviewer. But I don't think it's good for my personal brand.
The fact that you have a personal brand means that you're perfect for Cameo and Memo and Bebo and Flebo and
there's just something about it that I just don't reckon the average reader of a John Safran book or the average viewer of a John Safran music jamboree episode is going to be saying, oh, okay, $25 if. And John will wish me happy birthday. Like, it just
25 bucks. Don't shortchange yourself, John.
Or whatever it is. It just whatever.
Do you know what Kyle Sanderlands charges?
What?
$1,000 on Cameo.
Yeah, but that I'm not begrudging him because that just matches up with him. If you know what I mean. But I don't mean that in a moral way.
What was the next word there? It matches up with his what?
Oh, it's a bit like. It's a bit like, what's his name? Cartman from South Park can smoke marijuana, but Bart Simpson from The Simpsons can't. And it's just, there's things that kind of map with your personal brand. Maybe I've got to think of another word besides personal brand because it just sounds like I'm saying that in like some like cynical, cold, calculated way.
Well, it sounds to me like you're saying it as a euphemism for calling Kyle Sanderlands a dick.
No.
It's like, of course he would charge $1,000 because he's a fucktard. Like, he is a selfish man. He has a brand. And then you're like, oh, well, hang on. His brand is that he's kind of, aggressive or like big notes himself a lot.
No.
Nah. I'm just revealing my interior monologue, and I'm superimposing that onto you, a perfectly innocent bystander, John, and you are being asked to account for things you didn't say, and may not even have thought, that I've just created and placed in your mouth.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of something I could do that is a bit. I guess my entire career is doing things that are a bit dodgy, but yeah, like I'm trying to think, what could I get away with, kind of advertising or something?
Well,
like
cigarettes
that.
Now, obviously.
Yeah, cigarettes. You see, how screwed is that? That I can actually, just for anyone listening in, because my book was about investigating Philip Morris, the Melbro people. I thought it'd be fun for my photo shoots to wear like Melbro gear.
Yeah.
So I bought this really cool jacket, like racing jacket with Melbro on it, from Pakistan, in fact. I also got a cool Melbro top from the 90s. What else?
About Marlboro, the cigarette brand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there I was getting my photos taken like that because it just seemed cheeky and fun and what you're not meant to do. And then I found out, you're not meant to do it, and that's why the age will not be running any of my photographs of me in Melbro gear. And then the worst thing is that because I couldn't run it in those, they just had to get a file photo where my face was fatter than it is now. So that was like really unfair. But yeah, so how twisted is that? I can advertise Melbro, but only in this like really specific way. One, I'm not getting paid by them.
But where can you show those photos?
I put them on social media.
Right. Well, there you are. You're an influencer.
I know. Like your husband, I'm a social influencer. So I can, I put those up. It just feels like cheeky and fun. And I haven't really got in trouble. I got in practical trouble for it. Like they couldn't run it. But so far, public health organizations, you know, the kind of influencers that are on Twitter and stuff, they're still backing me.
Bless you. What is that, COVID? Have you got the Rona? Are you coming down with something?
But yeah, no, I wouldn't like leap to that straight away. As much as I trust getting diagnosed over the internet.
Well, I just, and I can't even see you.
By the partner of a social media influencer, I think.
A pro-vaccine social media influencer, shall I say, who has had to endure some ignominy from his peers about his controversial pro-science stance.
I did a video for Jews. I'm a Jew, for Jews getting the vaccine. Yeah. But I really only did it because they asked me, and I happened to think of like a funny idea. So, but that's okay, isn't it?
But like, is there an organization called Jews for Vaccines or something?
No, just a general.
If you're a Jew, get vaxxed.
Yeah, there's just like a Jewish organization. You know, the one you hear about ironically in those anti-vaxxer pages and posts about.
Yeah, right.
The secret Jewish organization
that controls the media.
Yeah, and is forcing you to get vaccines or whatever. They contacted me maniacally and said, can you help us in our plot to
inject the world with Bill Gates and George Soros DNA.
Microchip and stuff. And I said, yes.
Good for you.
So I did. So, yeah, I think about it, the more I realize I am a social media influencer. Although I don't know how many Jews actually got injected because I recommended it.
But well, anyway, there must have been a couple. There would have been a couple, I reckon. Yeah. But then, yeah, when you say Jews, my dad's Jewish, not religiously, and my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. So ethnically I'm Jewish. Mm-hmm. And when you say I'm a Jew, is that a little bit more provocative than saying I'm Jewish?
I don't know. I heard Billy Crystal talk about that decades ago, like way before everything had become sensitive and woke. So you might be hitting on something, because I saw this thing where Billy Crystal was going, "Don't say Jew, say a Jewish person," or something like that.
Right.
And but like,
was he taking the piss out of that, or was he serious?
No. He was being serious for some reason.
Not like Billy Crystal.
I say I get in trouble. I don't get in trouble because, like, but I say I like to say Jewess as well, which is like a real antiquated. And occasionally, I've never really got in trouble because Jews just, I don't understand how much you have to explain these days. Where, like, if you say something cheeky and you don't.
Well,
even,
everything. I mean, you have to, I mean, some people want you to explain absolutely
like,
everything.
Like, what's the joke? I don't even, sometimes I say stuff and I'm saying it because I think it's funny and people find it funny, but I don't exactly know why. So, why when I say Jewess is that funny? I don't know. I guess it's because. It is. You're being a bit inappropriate because you're not. Well, you're meant to these days. Not really.
I think it's the specificity of it. I think it's the old schooly specificity of it. There's something.
Yeah, it's
about...
like saying it's like saying Mohammedan instead of Muslim or something.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I once had Waleed Ali on my radio show.
Yeah,
and I called him a Mohammedan. I introduced him as that. And he...
I mean, you'll get cancelled for that at some stage.
No, I don't, there's like this line or whatever. Like, because why is it? It is. It's kind of making fun of the fact that, like, the language or something or the way. I don't even know.
Well, do you remember? Did it make news here when, in about 2015, Stephen Colbert, who still had the Colbert Report at the time, and Jon Stewart was still on the air, got into trouble because. Dan Snyder, who was the head of the Redskins football team, there's been a push to have them renamed because it's offensive to Native Americans, and he said, "Look, I'm not racist against Native Americans. I'm establishing this charity to fund Native American education. So why would I do that? And I'm also not going to change the team's name." Yeah. So Colbert went on the air and said, "I have been sometimes accused of being racist towards Asian people," and he showed clips of him doing this kind of sort of old schooly 1920s like Ching Chong Chinaman type act on his show, and he said, "I'm clearly not racist, and to prove it, I am hereby announcing the establishment of the Stephen Colbert Foundation for Ching Chong Ding Dongs or Orientals or whatever."
Oh,
or something like that. That was the joke.
So it was a joke and, making fun of.
Yeah, and he was making fun clearly of, he was satirizing the insincerity of another person's anti-racist self-identification. And a certain cohort of what would now be called woken at the time was just called confusingly hysterical Asian American activists called for the cancellation of the show. And at the time, I got ensnared in that whole thing because I was on the air in the States on HuffPost Live, and I interviewed the woman who was spearheading this campaign. I say woman. She was like a 22-year-old Korean-American activist who lived with her parents. But I was not particularly sympathetic to her point of view, and that alone went viral and got me in all sorts of trouble. And that was sort of the first shot across the bow of like the culture wars or of my involvement in the culture wars in some way. And what I thought was funny about Colbert's line is the use of the word Orientals. Like Orientals for me is a bit like Jewess. It's a word that is just on the border of being inappropriate. We're not entirely sure why. And it has something to do with the fact that only an old timey person would use such a word, and it's just not what we call that community anymore.
Yeah. So maybe I just get away with Jewess being a Jew or something.
Yeah, well, maybe partly, but also it may be that in 20 years' time, you'll be getting cancelled for this conversation now. Like, what if you called someone a Negress? What if you called someone of African descent a Negress?
Oh yeah, I'm trying to think. I think maybe even in my heyday, maybe I would have, maybe some alarm bells would have gone off about that, but you never know, or whatever.
What was your compulsion originally, John, when you were starting out? And we can get back to this is where we sort of pivot to the life story and youth story of Mr. John Safran. But for people who might be listening to us outside of Australia or who might not know you, give us a sense of how you exploded into public attention in the 90s and what you'd been up to before that.
Well, I guess it all starts in grade 3 when I realize I just have a creative impulse and I want to do something, but I just go to an ordinary, primary school. and then over primary school and high school and then getting into uni, I'm just sort of like poking around trying to figure out how to quench this creative desire. I try everything. Like, you know, when I'm a little kid, I'm trying to draw, can't draw. I put together school plays in grade five, form a band in high school, a hip hop band.
Hip hop?
Yeah, it was called Raspberry Cordial. I was MC.
What was your best song?
I'm taking full advantage of the fact that back then everything wasn't uploaded onto YouTube.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
It's just, there was a combination. There were songs that were like funny, which, I mean, there's lines in it that make me cringe, but overall it's okay. There was one called Melbourne Tram, about catching a tram in the morning. At 7 o'clock in the morning, I fall out of bed, get my school bag together to the tram stop ahead, I arrive. Back then, like, we weren't into
that. Wait, don't stop. I want to hear the song.
I arrive at the stop, 7:45, no surprises, the tram is late. Oh my God, if it gets cringier, it's like when something's dead, it can't be more dead. But for some reason, I feel like this can get more cringy than now. So I feel like I should pull the brakes on the tram.
I want your foot firmly on the tram accelerator, my friend. Or is it a foot? It's probably a handle. I want you pushing that lever.
No surprise, the tram is late. I can't recall it ever once being on time. The tram would be put in jail if being late was a crime. I'm goddamn very young at the time I'm writing this.
Wow.
20 minutes later, the tram comes at last, but it doesn't stop to let me on. It just rattles past. To make sure the next one stops, I lie down across the track. I mean, it wouldn't run me over, would it? Splat. So that's the end of like the first. Okay. The first.
Well, I like where it ended up. It was very innocent to begin with and very straightforward, and then it got macabre.
So I like that. So that's okay. But I also did a few sincere songs. They don't age well. The sincere ones. Anyway, so.
It sounded like you were about to give me a sincere one, and then you backed out.
Then so I just did things like that. But I was even doing things like auditioning to do some like comedy things, like on Hey Hate Saturday when they had like a call out to audiences. Like I was always like just trying to find some space, and I couldn't quite figure out what it was or whatever.
And did you have heroes at the time? Like when you were going on Hey Hey It's Saturday, which by the way, if you don't remember it or you're not an Australian, was a weekly sort of.
When I say I went on that, show, I mean, like I'm saying like when I was, I don't know, 14, 15, and they put a call out, hey, we're going to be at this shopping centre for the Great Aussie Joke. For the Great Aussie Joke. So if you've got a joke, come on down. That's what I mean when I.
I did that when they were like I think it must have been Hey they were like, we're gonna have an impression competition at Darling Harbour, and I went down and I did an impression of Phil Donahue I was probably like, you know, 14 or something on Hey Hey It's Saturday.
That would have got laughs. You don't realize you're 14, but the oldies are laughing at you just for being 14 and trying.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. For thinking that you can do a Phil Donahue impression. I was actually doing an impression of who was the great SNL impersonator who did Clinton and.
I don't know.
I can't remember his name. He did a great impression of Phil Donahue, and like everyone who's 14 trying to do impressions, you're basically doing an impression of an impressionist who you saw do a great impression. So I was just copying him. But what I was asking you about with Hey was at this time when you're trying to find some space in the universe for little John Safran to express his John Safran-ness to the cosmos, are you looking towards grown-ups who have careers that inspire you? Like, was Daryl wanted to be?
I don't know if I wanted to be I was still plodding around. So, but I like there's people I like, but I think as soon as I was in high school, I think I even though I like comedy and wanted to make it part of the work. I never really wanted to be like a straight comedian. Like, for instance, I've never done, besides the great Aussie joke on Hey Hey, I've never like done stand up or whatever. There was always like, I was always looking at things that had more of a, like a twist in the tail, if you want it. Not that like comedy's cool or whatever. Like when I was in grade five or whatever, I discovered Weird Al Yankovic. So that of course changed my life. Then
inspired you to become a macabre hip hop artist.
Well, yeah, I did a few parody songs myself, but then
can we hear one? And then I was into. Can you give me an insight into any of the parody songs?
Well, I did like Losing My Papigeon to Losing My Religion.
Papigeon,
yeah, pigeon, papigeon,
right. Just someone anyway, stuttering. Yeah,
don't worry. Don't worry about like you got to like edit things out of the life story of anyone, right? So like we don't need a sort of like an episode of when what's his name, the guy who does those
like this is your life series,
right? No, yeah, Ryan Murphy, where does like the Betty Gable story or whatever. Then they have to leave some stuff on the cutting room floor.
No, so I'm fully
Ryan
aware
Murphy
of that,
does I... my. My goddamn anthology, when it's the season is John Safran, they're still gonna have to leave some things on the cutting room floor.
Ryan Murphy what he can and can't put in your own life story. Some things
I'm telling you, it's
floor.
Gonna be a low rating episode.
Everyone wants Losing My Papigeon. That's the bit you keep. You don't keep all the rest. You do an entire anthology about Losing My Papigeon.
So yeah, I was into comedy, but. And me and my friends were obsessed with the D Generation, who were this comedy troupe that were on morning radio at the time. And they went on to be the Working Dog people and the panel people, like Santo Chilaro and
Tom Gleisner, Rob Sitch, Jane
yeah,
Kennedy,
all those
Nick Malloy.
Guys. Yeah, so me and my friends were obsessed with them and would turn up like when they did, because they broadcast out of Melbourne. So if they did an outside broadcast, me and my friends would wag high school and go there. And just I was into all the stuff, like me and my friends were obsessed with Monty Python and just the usual stuff. And then when I discovered hip-hop, that's when like it really gelled, because you were able to do funny things, but there was a sting in the tail, and you're allowed to like weave in and out of, well, it's funny, but it's also got this other layer to it, or it's got this other layer to it, and it's also funny. So but then anyway, so there's just that. Then I left after high school. I started studying journalism. So I guess that's writing. And then I was also doing a copywriting course at night. And then I got a job in an ad agency as a copywriter. So I left the journalism course. Then, okay, now we're finally getting to something anyone would be interested in, maybe, is that ABC put out and this is like 1997. They put out an ad on the TV saying, "Oh, we need 8 young people who've never been on TV before or been in the media. We want to send them around the world separately, and they have to send back a documentary every 10 days on this show called Race Around the World." And I'd never thought about doing a documentary before, or even being on TV before that much, you know, like even though despite what you might think because of my great Aussie joke appearance on Hey Hey Saturday, it wasn't really a particular desire of mine, but I just put in a submission for that. Just like I tried out things in grade 3 or whatever. It was just like, okay, I'll have a go at this or whatever. Then I got on the show. Then I got into my groove, and then that became my shtick. The shtick.
Yeah, I mean, you just glossed over that like it was just another thing in your life. But for people who don't remember, I mean, I was in my teens at the time, and that I guess you were in your mid 20s when you got that, and it was
early 20s.
It was a phenomenon. I mean, it was a huge. I was trying to explain it. I was trying to remember what the show actually was and explain it to my partner last night. But I mean, it captivated the country.
Yeah, so the context is that back in those days, like TV was much more official, and like for instance, you had good lighting on TV shows. So this thing that we've just kind of adapted to now, where our eyes are adapted to, someone can shoot something on their phones, or now phones are becoming really good cameras or whatever. But remember that kind of in between time, you know, like if someone like caught something in the real world and it's just on their crappy Handycam or something like that. Like that used to not be TV. TV used to be things have to be well lit. People have to be attractive.
Well, also the people who you saw on TV, as you say, not just attractive, right. but they were experienced. I mean, there were gatekeepers of television. There was no,
and they were kind of like channels,
and they were all, you know, people who had dedicated their lives to the craft of broadcasting. And here was a show where young little Jewish whippersnappers like yourself were just roaming around the world with a handy cam, sending back these electrifying mini documentaries.
Yeah, so even the whole thing, we luckily had the first generation of cameras that had ever come out that had a flip screen where you could turn it and therefore hold it and shoot this video diary. Like before that, you'd have to set up on a tripod and do
it. It was the first selfie, essentially.
Yeah, it was the first selfie. And so people were even like blown away by that. Like you'd be sitting at home watching your TV and there was like a little bit of the internet, but not too much, and definitely not social media or YouTube or anything like that. And so people were just like blown away that like, what's this badly lit thing where this guy's squeezing his nose and squeaking into, like, it just seemed really odd and unusual.
Was the point that voters voted on whose documentary was the best? How did you win? I can't remember. Okay, don't worry. Sorry. Finish whatever thought you were on path to finish.
The other context, and this is relevant to me or whatever, because what I did, I knew I wanted to do something a bit quirky and fun, but I hadn't quite landed on what exactly that was. So my first couple of episodes were the first couple of like 4-minute videos. Cause it was like 4 or 5 minutes. You had to submit every 10 days and you're in a different country each time. And I didn't really know what I was doing. And then I got to the Ivory Coast, like by about, this was about story 3 or 4. And I'd broken up with my girlfriend, and it'd really been heartbreaking. And I had a letter from her and I had a photo from her. And so I did this thing that starts off like it's going to be a conventional National Geographic thing of like, you're exploring another interesting culture and I'm going to look into voodooism. And I did that, but I did it through the lens of, I'm bitter and twisted because I've just broken up with a girlfriend and I've got a love letter. And I've got her photos, and I'm going to go around to voodoo doctors around the Ivory Coast in West Africa and try to have a voodoo curse put on her. And through that, learn this other culture and their ritual, their unexpected ritual compared to. And as soon as I did that, I was like, this is it. This is like somehow all those years of trying to figure out where my place in the universe was. This is it being, I'm exploring something that's worth exploring on some like regular journalistic level. And, but I'm in a self-aware way, making it all about me because you're not meant to, but the audience is kind of aware that I'm aware, if you know what I mean. So it's not like classic straight line narcissism, and I'd say it's even the opposite. It's kind of acknowledging that you're never a fly on the wall when you're a journalist. You're never like some independent got some bird's eye view or whatever. Like you're bringing your own life.
A little bit like using the word Jewess.
Yeah,
maybe. Like it's, you know, well, in the sense that it's self-aware.
I would say it's humble. I tell you why. Because you are acknowledging that what you're doing is not this sort of impartial journalism where you're telling the whole truth or you're seeing every angle. You're saying, no, this is my eyes coming into this or whatever. Anyway, so it was like investigating something, making it personal and making it a bit funny and inappropriate, because I mean, that was the other layer to it where you know, back then at least, it's like, oh no, if you go to another culture, like you should be like very, you know, quiet and reverential and sort of like almost like examine them as if it's like some kind of zoo or something like that.
Yeah.
And whilst I'm just like clomping around with me being me, but anyway, so I broke up with my girlfriend. So it's one wonder you thought. And okay. So then, the other context that's important to know is this was like before Chaser, before Ali G or Borat, And so that was another like weird thing about my little things. Like people were going like, what's the reference to this? Like, yeah. So it wasn't like if you watch something now and you go, oh, I get what he's doing. He's doing that thing that all those people do or whatever. And the reason I luckily had that in my arsenal, because I wasn't really, not at all. I don't really like pranking or things like that. But very luckily, when I was in first year uni, and I was like obsessed with finding out about like different countercultural movements, just cause I don't know. I went to a, like a really religious Jewish school, and before there was the internet, so therefore, when I kind of got into first year uni, I was like, I just went crazy. I was like, oh, I want to know about this and that and that and that. And one of the things I learned about was this group called the Yippies, not the hippies or the yuppies, but the Yippies, who I think like maybe very early 70s, was it even late 60s? I don't know, but around there. And they were like this movement of, and one of their like figureheads was this guy called Abby Hoffman. And he'd written this book. He'd written a book called Steal This Book. So you walk into a bookshop and there's a book and it's called Steal This Book. It's like, well, hang on, what am I meant to do with that, right? But he'd do these, he was a bit of an activist, and he'd do these, I guess what now would be these sort of like trolling exercises that and where everything's a bit ambiguous and it's got social commentary, but it's not really hectoring and it's not really like wagging your finger, and it's also like a bit hard to pin down exactly what the social activism is, I guess. So for instance, one thing I heard about him is, because he was against the war, like the Vietnam War, and so he organized holding hands around the Pentagon to try to levitate the Pentagon. So it was kind of like stuff like that. So
he was, it's funny you mentioned Borat, because, you know, he was played by Sacha Baron Cohen in the, there was a movie last year called The Trial of the Chicago Seven, which was written by
Abby Hoffman. Yeah, yeah, that's
yeah,
good
and
point.
Abby Hoffman was one of the protagonists in that, and Sacha Baron Cohen played him.
Yeah, so and then and through that, I'd kind of learned about there was this countercultural thing of social justice, kind of, or not social justice, but having some meaning. Usually, there was usually a lot of meaning about around mob mentality, and. And that sort of like was the subtext of a particular, you know, a prank or what do they call them on YouTube now? Because they're not funny. A social experiment.
Social experiment.
And also, it'd be different if it was like, oh, they're not funny, but they're trying to sort of like posh them up a bit. Like, oh, it's not a prank. It's a social experiment. That's why I'm throwing slime on these people. That's why I'm throwing slime on these paid actors who I'm pretending are real people down the street. So then when I was overseas and I had to like pull a rabbit out of the hat, for some reason I remembered this, even though like when I was reading the stuff about the Yippies, it wasn't like important. It wasn't like, oh my God, these are my people. Or it wasn't like I particularly bonded or whatever. I just kind of remembered it. And I also remember around the same time I went on a holiday with some friends, and there were like friends of friends there, whatever. And there was this guy who would always be pulling these pranks. And I just found it very interesting. I was going, and back then there was like a prank was just considered very lowbrow. It wasn't like now where you can use it up or whatever. And anyway, so when I was overseas, that all kind of conflated in my head together. And I was like, this is what I'm meant to do. I'm meant to do this kind of yippie, like my friend on the holiday thing, where I do this thing and it's really uncomfortable. I'm not really like enjoying it that much. But I'm immersed in something, and I guess there's a bit of complication to it, because on the one hand, it's cool I'm immersing myself in somewhere. Like, I'm not looking at people like they're in the zoo and I'm somehow, you know, the outsider or whatever. But then there's the other side to it of like, you know, John, is it really appropriate of you getting baptized?
Well, I mean, the answer in 2021 would be no. I mean, all of those things would have caused a national furore if they were done today.
I guess so. I mean, it's really hard to sort of do that sort of time travel thing or whatever.
Well, given the smallest slights that people say, given that cultural appropriation is a sin for which you can have your entire career derailed. For you to be parachuting into foreign cultures and screwing around with them and not showing them the appropriate reverence that a white colonialist Jew probably should would land differently. I'm not saying that today's
No. You see, this is what I reckon I do, and I probably will do it today, like with my next book or whatever like that. I'd probably try to examine that notion or whatever.
I did
in my last book, except I didn't explain it well enough, so I want to give it another go or whatever. It's pretty rich.
Considering
what the world has kind of culturally appropriated from Jewish people, and when I talk about that, I'm talking about real big ticket items like the Quran and the New Testament, like both, how much more important and culturally influencing are things like the Quran and the New Testament, right? And both of those culturally appropriate from the Jewish Torah. You know, they just take stories from it. And so anyway, so...
Well, I mean, everything...
In that context, I find it a bit... It's like... And people will go, oh, that's like some... Like, oh, that's somehow an example you're giving that's not relevant to the conversation? Or it's like, why? How is not the fact that these two really important books that influence the world, the New Testament and the Quran, and that they culturally appropriated, to use that expression, the Torah, the Jewish book, how is that not a good example of, obviously, this is a very complicated issue that it's a bit rich to kind of just have some glib, like one sentence answer of, oh, you shouldn't culturally appropriate because
I mean, glib is all we do these days, John, it seems like. I mean, cultural appropriation, the whole conversation around that is intentionally sort of glib and parochial and insular, because from a broader perspective, everything that progressive people value about life is fueled by some form of cultural appropriation. We love multiculturalism, and we love, you know, the richness of, for example, the way that Indians speak English and their unique words that they've pilfered from here and there, the kinds of cross blending of cuisines that has created all of the world's greatest cooking and stuff. Like all of it's the exciting mishmash of and the collision rich.
I'd take it in a slightly different way. I mean, what you're saying is true or whatever, but I'd kind of be a bit more, a bit more kind of going into battle or whatever like that, where, you know how everyone thinks they don't have an accent and everyone else has an accent? Everyone's got an accent. I don't have an accent or whatever. Yeah. It's like, I feel like people don't know how much their existence is cultural appropriation, and they're aware of everyone. Like, for instance, like if anyone's a hyphenated American, you're speaking English. And so when I say that, it's like that. Let me phrase that slightly differently. They're already bending cultures, even if they're part of it. So, for instance, if you're just say who has the right to perform Mulan, that Chinese story or whatever. And already, if you're performing it in English, if you're like a Chinese American, you're performing it in English, and therefore, which is cool. That's just like, you have an accent is what I'm saying. It's like you're already bending this thing that wasn't originally like that. It's not like a big dramatic statement. I'm just saying everyone's got an accent, and everyone
is engaged in cultural appropriation. I mean, it depends how far back you go. Like Kim Kardashian got in hot water for wearing her hair in braids because that's an African American thing, and she's pilfering African American culture. But the African Americans didn't invent hair braids. That came from, like, the Egyptians had hair braids, so the African Americans were culturally appropriating it from the
ancient Egyptians. I guess my thing is more, I find it, if there's 200 countries on Earth, and I'm not sure why Americans get to make these rules. It's like it's. I know there's a bit of a complex thought, but I feel like these conversations are not American cultural imperialism, but kind of, it's like you have these people in America and they set the scene of, and set the table for these issues where I want to hear, what Romanians think.
Yeah,
I want to hear what,
I want to hear
what Black Australians think.
Yeah,
and
I also want to hear what actual Black Americans think, as well as Black Australians, Romanians, because so much of this is driven by a very small educated cohort of white university-educated elites.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not disagreeing. I just find it weird that Americans just get to, like, yeah, it's like I say, I want to hear what Black Australians have to say.
Yeah,
much
yeah.
more than, you know, like than Americans. Like, and to give you like a for instance of there's something here is that I know these and I know there's been some there was tension one time when it was probably like a couple of decades ago now where there's this Black American group quite radical called the Nation of Islam. And they came to Australia, some of them as missionaries, and they went into like at least one Aboriginal community because this is where I heard the story. And it was like, oh well, you know, you should join us because we've got the same struggle. Da 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 da. And they just felt this was very foreign to them. It's like this American thing was very foreign to them. And the other thing I always think about is yonks ago I saw this documentary about this. Were they punk or were they heavy metal? Oh, heavy metal maybe. And they were Pakistani Americans and Muslim Americans, and they were in a heavy metal band. And this was a couple of decades ago, and so it was closer to 9/11, so things were a bit more like with the whole Muslim thing was a bit more heated than maybe it is now or whatever. But anyway, so their whole shtick, well, not their whole shtick, but their angle was like almost like we're not Americans. We're Pakistanis or we're Muslims or whatever, and we're in a heavy metal band. And that's how they kind of had this internal perception of themselves. And, you know, we're Pakistani in this American world or whatever like that, in this American scene or whatever, this white scene or whatever. Cool, fine. But anyway, at the end of the documentary, they go to Pakistan, you know, because they hadn't been there because they were like kids of immigrants or whatever. And then when they're in Pakistan, they're just acting and they're just being treated like any other loudmouth American who comes there. So it's not like the Pakistani people there are like, oh, come, our brothers, come home. It's like they're just loudmouth Americans floppering around or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, those Americans never are really – there seems to be not really a lot of acknowledgement from hyphenated Americans that they're Americans, and that has – some impact on things in their worldview, in their culture, and in if we're gonna live in a world about, well, who has the right to say this or that, it's like, well, you're American, like maybe if we're gonna live in this world where it's like certain identities mean you can't say, oh, you should be a bit more apprehensive about just squawking, maybe having Americanness in you should be one of those identities where, you know, where it's like, well, hang on, I'm an American and we have cultural dominance around the world. So maybe that should be in the mix.
Maybe we should tone down the thought policing of the rest of the world, of like dragging the rest of the world into our own domestic culture wars and universalizing our experience as if it was global.
Just kind of being aware. I'm kind of like playing by the rules that are set out where it's like, well, if you've got this certain identity or that identity, you should, you should be kind of not just blab all the time. You should understand that you're coming from a place of privilege. If you've got this identity, that identity, that identity, and I'd say, okay, cool. And let's add American to that. It just doesn't mean Americans shouldn't talk or whatever, but it's just like there should be some acknowledgement that, like, for decades, it's like a cultural steamroller around the world. Which is cool. Like, they've won in the marketplace of ideas, and I obviously love American culture. But anyway, blah.
It's interesting. I love the point. It's interesting. How do you feel about the identity-driven nature of conversation, the fact that you know, well, for I the just two try of to, us as white males.
I try to do
to
my own thing
about.
Or whatever. Like, because there's obviously truth in things, so it's really hard to... My book, Puff Piece, which is about how part of... One of the threads, it's not like a big thing in the book or whatever, but it's talking about how, because Philip Morris and Melbourne people, how they've managed to launch this new product to no apparent notice, let alone criticism. And it's this new product, and just, I mean, it's not a vape. It's this thing that's a cigarette, but they've rebranded it as not a cigarette. And it's been like, they've managed to weave around the ban on menthol cigarettes in Europe by launching this thing. It's got a heat stick, which is tobacco rolled in paper with a filter at one end that you plant between your lips, inhaling nicotine and tobacco into your lungs, and then exhaling this thing that kind of looks a lot like smoke and has smoke constituents in it. Anyway, wow. But regardless, like, I'm talking about, like, why is this thing that's really consequential? Because it was the beginning of the end for Philip Morris across Europe. The menthol cigarettes last year were banned, and the European Parliament was going to go on presumably to ban all cigarettes. And so this was really the beginning and the end of this huge, the world's largest tobacco cigarette company, right? And then they come up with this cheeky little clever way of just rewording things and changing a few things around the edges, around the how you produce a cigarette. And they get around it. So menthol cigarettes are banned across Europe, but menthol heat sticks aren't. And so their game can go on where, you know, at the moment, 8 million people die a year of cigarette-related injuries. Cigarette-related causes. That's out of 52 million people die of everything around the world, and out of that, 8 million of them are cigarettes, right? Anyway, so they managed to grab victory from the jaws of defeat, Philip Morris, and there's not like... Not only is there not a book written about it besides mine, there's not like an article written about it. They've somehow done this incredible thing. There's not a tweet about it. And anyway, my point being is I'm starting to look in my book. I look into, well, why is this? Why did Philip Morris just get away with this incredibly great ruse that no one noticed? And part of it was, is that Philip Morris are woke and they avoid standing, I think by luck, there's a bit of luck to it, but they avoid stepping on these cultural landmines that are likely to draw attention, and those things around identity politics, for instance. So, you know, like they do things, they've got an in-house LGBT unit, they even supported the pull down of their American chapter, supported the pulling down of Confederate statues during Black Lives Matter. They frame things in the language of today, and because they do that, and because that's the only framework where some young people see the world of, and that means that a company can do something as problematic as insanely sort of like something worthy of examination by social justice types, which is the continuation of the death of 8 million people a year. And it's kind
wait,
of escapes
it. Can I ask you, though, John, about that
what?
Point? Because can I just ask you about the point of the deadliness of these heat sticks? Isn't Philip Morris's claim that the carcinogens are in the combustibles?
Okay, we can talk about that. Let's talk about that. But can I just close off this point?
Please.
Because I already barely make sense when I'm staying on track. So a point I bring up in the book, and it's not like a big point or whatever, but it is, it's like Philip Morris have avoided these cultural landmines that are going to get you cancelled. And so they can continue, not only can they continue this practice, but their practice isn't something that's going to be particularly noticed by, like I talk in the book that if a Philip Morris executive was caught posting online them shooting a lion, you know, on an African safari.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like that would be a nightmare. And they might lose their job, but they can be an executive complicit in the death of 8 million people a year.
Yeah.
And somehow that sort of like avoids it. But then I also, and there's another ironic layer to this, is because actually if you think Black Lives Matter, the like cigarette companies, and this is like one of these things where there's just different ways to look at it. But for instance, in New Zealand, amongst the indigenous community there, they're 30% more likely to smoke. Or is it 30? I don't know. It might even be three times as likely. Sorry, I think it might be even three times as likely to smoke. Anyway, regardless of what it is, it's like the smoking rate and thus the rate of indigenous people dying of cancer is at such a higher rate in a place like New Zealand. And I understand like the smoking rate amongst indigenous Australians is up. So it's sort of like it is on a deeper level, on a less surface veneer level, it is actually you can pretty easily cobble together a case that Philip Morris is anti-black. And according to the British government, because they looked into this, I think the LGBT community smokes at a much higher rate than the non-LGBT community. So it is, ironically, despite what I've just said, like if you would, they're not woke. They're not woke on it. If you think giving Indigenous people cancer is unwoke, then Philip Morris actually are unwoke. Okay, so this now let's draw a line under that and get into.
I'm going to loop back to that, but yes, in this big arcing circle, let's just address the elephant in the room about vaping being better for you than smoking.
Well, you see, you've like this isn't a vape. So already this, like what you've said there, just demonstrates how brilliant Philip Morris are at muddling things. So it's hard to...
Yeah, so clarify it for us. What's a heat stick? What's a vape? What's a cigarette?
Okay. So a cigarette has tobacco leaf, and that's infused, that's with nicotine, and nicotine naturally occurs in tobacco leaf. And when you light a cigarette, it generates tar and the tar generated by this tobacco leaf, that's the deadly thing in a cigarette. Then you've got, okay, so is that makes sense?
Yep, totally. Yep.
So then you've got vaping, and with vaping, you're heating up a liquid, and the liquid has nicotine, because you can extract nicotine from tobacco. So you can have nicotine without the tobacco, if you know what I mean. So yeah. in a vape, you're heating up this liquid that contains nicotine, propylene glycerol, flavorings, and other ingredients and agents, but it doesn't contain tobacco leaf. So therefore, because a vape doesn't contain tobacco leaf, it doesn't generate tar. So therefore, a vapor could say, and it's right, that the most deadly thing in a cigarette, the tar, isn't in a vape. But then it becomes this other matter of you still are inhaling things into your body, into your respiratory system, and whether they're a danger, even a very, very dire danger, that's sort of like separate to the danger of... you're inhaling tar because you're not inhaling tar.
Yeah. But anyway, you're not inhaling any burnt particles because there's no combustion going on. You're not inhaling the fragments of microscopic ash that come off burning something with a flame.
Then we get to the heat stick, which is what we just talked about there was vaping, and that's very distinct to this thing called a heat stick. So a heat stick looks just like a cigarette because it's tobacco rolled in paper with a filter at one end. And I guess the salient point is that they contain tobacco leaf, unlike a vape, but like a cigarette. So therefore, they generate tar. Therefore, the thing that's most deadly in a cigarette is also in a heat stick.
What do they do? How do I consume?
So this is what they play this great game of misdirection. So this is what they'd say. They'd say that a cigarette you light with a lighter, and that when it catches a light, a cigarette, it goes through this process called combustion. And they say the combustion is what creates the smoke, and the smoke that goes into your body is what's deadly in a cigarette. And they, so their case is what they say, and then I'll do the fact check afterwards. They say with this heat stick, you put it into this device, and it looks a bit like an astronaut's pen or something. It looks kind of cool. And then what happens is you press this button and it heats up this tobacco. So it heats the tobacco to an incredible degree, but they say it never actually catches a light. Therefore, it doesn't combust. And because it doesn't combust, it doesn't generate smoke. Therefore, what you're inhaling isn't smoke. Therefore, and usually they don't say this directly. They just let you come to this conclusion yourself. They say, therefore, it's a less risky version of a cigarette because you're not inhaling smoke.
Right.
I can't. And already, there's like 17 misdirections going on in there. I'll give you a couple of them. One is I looked into what makes a cigarette like work, and these are according to the American Medical Association. And when you light a cigarette with a lighter, it actually starts generating smoke, not when it catches a light and starts to combust. It actually starts generating smoke, this isn't a traditional cigarette, when it's heated to an incredible degree and it becomes so hot, and there's this little process before combustions called pyrolysis, and that's when the smoke starts generating. So even on that level, Philip Morris's claim that, oh, hang on, we've got this new thing and it doesn't catch fire and therefore it doesn't combust, therefore it's not generating smoke, doesn't even quite map or scan, because in a traditional cigarette, you don't, according to scientists, and it's mainstream science.
Anyone who's lit a cigar knows that the cigar begins to smoke before it begins to combust.
Yeah. I mean, and so then on top of that, so there's this discharge, which they claim isn't smoke because it hasn't been generated
by fire,
which is already, yeah, like, as I said, it's already like fudgy there. But when you dig into their, because even though they try to hold their cards close to their chest, because they need to get this approved by government bodies, they have to put it in like mountains and mountains of paperwork, obviously. And there they often have to tell the truth. Or there's at least enough truth in there, and they want to have like two stories going, like what they tell the public and then what they need to say to get their product approved. And if you dig deep enough into that, you find out that they do acknowledge that there's smoke toxicants in this discharge, which they claim isn't smoke. Their argument is that there's not enough of it for it to be classified as smoke by the definition of smoke, which they've made up. You know what I mean? So, all that crazy. Right. But here's like one of the real two big massive misdirections. And they're so clever at making you not look at what you should be looking at. Because even what I've just explained now, I've explained it in a very different way to how Philip Morris does. Because all they talk about this device, this sort of astronaut's pen that I was talking about that heats up the heat stick, and they just concentrate on this, and they just pitch this. It's like, oh, we've got this new device. It's called an IQOS, IQOS, and you know, it's like nothing before because it heats, it doesn't light, blah blah blah. It's got a light, blah, blah. But this is their first act of misdirection, because they want you to concentrate on this, because if you look at the heat stick, the thing you slide into it, you, as soon as you look at that, you go, hang on, that just looks like a cigarette. So they're doing everything. The actual launch is a misdirection of trying to make you look at this device instead. And then they kind of, they're very quiet about the heat. Like they go, oh, it heats up. You put in this little tobacco unit. They use the term tobacco unit, and they try to make out like it's like this little side point, as opposed to it's the point.
They've sort of got, it's like they've got a turd, but they've put it in a little miniature Tesla, and they want everyone to look at the cool Tesla and ignore the turd sitting inside.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like already, how insane is that the actual product launch is a misdirection of not making you look at look at the thing that they're actually inside. Launching. That's sort of like that's actually the salient point.
And so do you buy the refills for the heat sticks from Philip Morris as well? And is it one use and then you throw it away? So you're basically buying packets of quasi cigarettes that need this thing to go in them. You can't use a real cigarette in the heat stick.
No.
Canister. Right.
No. So, I mean, that's another reason why they do that, why they want that. But anyway, so there's that. But get this, this is even a bigger ingenious misdirection. This is how smart they are. And I only picked this up, like I'd already handed in two drafts of my book to the publisher. And then I'm like driving on going, God damn, they've got me again or whatever. And this is how they got me again. And luckily I got to write the third draft. So Philip Morris does this whole thing about how they're looking to a smoke-free future. And the reason they say that is because they claim this device doesn't generate smoke, which it does, but let's pretend it doesn't, right? And their argument is that the reason why you should trust us and we're moving away from cigarettes and we're now a health enterprise is because, you see, the thing that kills you in a cigarette is the smoke, and this doesn't generate smoke. Let's pretend that's the truth. It doesn't generate smoke, right? Let's go along with their reality, right? So I'm driving along and I'm going, hang on, that's both true and also a massive misdirection at the same time, because what it is what kills you in a cigarette is smoke, but more specifically, what kills you in a cigarette is the tar in the smoke. So therefore, the question isn't, oh, does this new heat stick generate smoke? It's the question is, does this new heat stick generate tar? And so let's go along with their reality of, like, this doesn't generate smoke. It's like, well, who cares if it's generating the tar that is the reason a cigarette's deadly in the first place? And yes, this does generate tar. So, like, they're just so brilliant at these misdirections. And of course, the other thing is where people like to go on these conversations about, and like, oh, isn't anything better than a cigarette? And isn't it like got lower carcinogens or something like that? Everything they say, by the way, is like, you've got to be really, it's usually very tricky. So, but even if you took them at face value, again, very late on when I was writing this book, I was thinking to myself, well, why do people hate cigarettes? It's like, oh, it's because they give you cancer. And so really the only question to Philip Morris that's relevant with this new product, it's not like, is this smoke? Is this tar? Is this a cigarette? Or does this have lower carcinogen? Or whatever it is. Really, the only question that's relevant is, will this give me cancer? Or will this not give me cancer?
In the way
your Marlboro cigarettes give me cancer. And I got onto a science Zoom with them and I asked the question. And because no one's interested in this topic for whatever reason, I could get my question answered because no one else is asking questions.
Mm.
And I got them for the first time because I guess they didn't really think it through, the consequence of answering this question, because no one's asked them before. And I said, will this give me, I asked the question, well, I even framed it the way I just framed it to you. I wasn't tricky. I said, the reason people hate cigarettes is because they give you cancer. Will this not give me cancer? The same cancer that like a Melbourne world, whatever. And the woman from Philip Morris starts off with a lot of, oh, we found that there's 95% less this and that, blah, 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 blah. But then she wraps it up by going, when it comes to your specific question of how this affects cancer, we haven't done research into that. You know, like the research.
Well, for a start, they can't, because it takes decades to show up. I mean, you need human trials to last over a generation in order to know.
Man, I can't believe that's your outtake on this. Is like Philip Morris, poor Philip Morris.
That's not
little
what I'm
David
saying.
Against Goliath John Safran. He's like, it's because they're so ethical. Philip Morris don't want to make a call on whether this product gives them cancer.
That's
because
what
they
I'm
want
saying.
To they want they you want to that. Cross dot their I's and cross their T's and make sure what they're saying is very truthful after doing years and years of research.
No, the thing about cigarettes is also not just cancer. It's that it gives you massively higher risk of heart disease and of stroke and of a whole bunch of other things, which seem to be related to your lungs being unable to get oxygen into your system as effectively as they otherwise would. And you would imagine that your lungs being coated in tar would impede all of those processes pretty badly, yeah. even if there is no combustible material. But I'm just making the point that, of course, you're not going to get a straight answer out of a multinational corporation that's been hiding behind, behind manufactured uncertainty for generations, because they're able to manufacture the same uncertainty right here until we've had human guinea pigs roll it out in their real lives. Where are these things allowed?
So they're forbidden in Australia, but I've got one because I'm edgy and I bought an illegal one. Right. So if suddenly you hear sirens and my door being broken down, it's because the cops are coming in because I've got my illegal IQOS
and heat stick. Illegal Jew with his stash of...
Which I bought with a tobacco from the boot. I didn't order it from overseas. That would have been not very dynamic for a book. Mm. I got it in a car park at night in Doncaster, Melbourne, out of the boot of a car from this dude who imported them. I think every couple of months he went to Japan and he came back with a suitcase filled with IQOSes, that's the heating device, and heat sticks.
But, so where are these things being used?
Well, they're legal across Europe because that's how they weaveled. That's weaveled is a combination of weaving and being a weasel, a weevil. By weaveling around the laws there, that they've been permitted in America by their and so this has all happened invisibly in because our eyes haven't been on it, and so much works in Philip Morris's favor. I my only conclusion is that God really likes Philip Morris, because for instance, in America, because kids were dying and others were ending up in hospital because they were inhaling black market vape juice.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure lots of people listening remember that. They go, well, that was a big news story. So there's a lot of eyes on vaping, but what, just unbelievable. I can't believe their luck. So whilst all eyes are on that, in America, the Federal Drug Administration in America permitted the heat stick and the IQOS. And so that's and they've already started building dedicated stores to sell this, and no one's noticed. Even though there's all this, that should be something totally examined and constant. And it's even on the level of, well, hang on, if you're worried about vaping, God damn it, you should be worried about this. It's like whether you're worried about vaping or not worried about vaping, you should be worried about this, and it isn't. And also there's lots of little stings in the tail and tangles. For instance, at the moment, the US government, branches of the US government, the Federal Drug Administration, is looking at whether to really crack down on vaping. And in America, in some ways, that's going to serve Philip Morris's purposes, because it's like they've got into the castle and now they're drawing, with their IQOS and heat stick. And now it's the drawbridge is going up again. So, and it's a very tangled thing that's hard to give a simple story, because, for instance, Philip Morris in America, or their parent company, is invested in a vape company there called Juul. But I would say my op-ed is, when push comes to shove, ultimately Philip Morris, they see their future in tobacco. And so things like the IQOS and the heat stick, which we've been talking about, that's really what their future is. And them dabbling into vaping as pure vaping is more a... They're a huge behemoth with all these different, people doing different things or whatever. So, yeah, of course, they've got their fingers in vaping a little bit or whatever. But ultimately, they would want – vaping's their competitor. And, their dream has come true in Japan. In Japan, vaping is forbidden, but these heat sticks and IQOS are permitted. And that's
– Really?
Yeah. So the reason Philip Morris would want to – pardon?
What's the thinking behind that?
Well, there's different – laws in different countries. So one thing that's just shows how brilliant and entangled Philip Morris is in some countries, they essentially argue, I'm simplifying this, but they essentially argue that seeing cigarettes are legal, how can this not be legal?
Right.
Because it's so similar to a cigarette. And right. They go, and that's their argument. That's an argument they made in Australia. It didn't work or whatever, but so when they were trying to get this introduced in Australia, it wasn't like, hey, vaping and this should be introduced. No, it wasn't that. It was like, this is heated tobacco. It's tobacco, and tobacco is already legal. And then they have this tangled argument where they're like, how can you ethically approve cigarettes but not this? When we say this is, how can you live with yourself, Australian government?
At the risk of yet again sounding like a shill for Philip Morris, they've got a logical point there, right? I mean,
this is where they don't have a lot. They don't have a logical point there. I'd say they'd have an arguable point if they were trying to get a vape approved. This isn't a vape, it's a cigarette. So their whole thing of like...
Right, but cigarettes are legal.
Oh, cigarettes are legal, so why? Oh, cool. Yeah, okay, that's fine.
That's what I'm saying. If they have a logical point to say that if you want to, if this category of product should be illegal, then outlaw cigarettes. And if you're not going to outlaw cigarettes, then for the sake of consistency, you have to approve this product as well.
Well, okay. Well, yeah, that's true. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it, though, is that when cigarettes were approved was a different, it's basically the horse has bolted. So cigarettes are approved. And if a cigarette was introduced today, they wouldn't be approved. And in fact, now we have the perfect test case to do that with the heat stick, which is a cigarette being introduced today. So I don't think it's as hypocritical. Definitely it can be seen as that. Like it makes sense what your argument is.
John, I want to loop back to the bigger question that you raised that I said we'd come back to about the sort of corporate hypocrisy in presenting themselves as good corporate citizens at the same time as they are not only unleashing this product, which they know is going to kill people or they strongly suspect, but they're also doing it in such a way that overwhelmingly targets disadvantaged people, people of colour, First Nations people, and so on, because those people smoke more than the white liberal elites who congratulate corporations on their woke policies do. You know, you mentioned LGBT people. There was also, it amused me this past Pride, I saw a comparison of the social media front pages of a bunch of corporations, which on Pride in like the United States and Australia and Europe all had like rainbow flags and everything. And then you look at the pages in Middle Eastern countries of the same corporations and they're completely silent about Pride, of course, just showing up the total cynicism and hypocrisy. Like if you care about gay rights, then you should promote gay rights to people who don't care about gay rights, not to the populations that you know are already on board. If you're actually taking a stand and then sticking up for something, then stick up for it where it hurts, not where it only advantages your bottom line. And similarly, I mean, Apple, do you know Antonio Garcia Martinez, he wrote a book called Chaos Monkeys. He was a Facebook executive and he got hired by Apple earlier this year. And then a campaign, he was basically cancelled and fired from Apple because someone excerpted a paragraph from his Chaos Monkeys, which was a memoir about his time at Facebook and in Silicon Valley, which was a kind of overblown satire of Silicon Valley. I'm only talking about him because he reminds me a bit of you just in terms of being an independent thinker, someone who doesn't follow the rules, someone who doesn't care about what other people, you know, fitting into the box that other people have set up for them. And he had a passage in this book that was sort of snide about Silicon Valley women and saying that like there's this kind of sort of power hungry, trashy type of female in Silicon Valley. And that was regarded as being anti-feminist, and so there was a big campaign by Apple employees that misogyny, you know, sexism is not welcome here and so on. So he was fired as an Apple executive basically before his tenure had even begun. And his point was, this is a company that employs massive like slave labor across China putting together these devices that doesn't give a shit about human rights wherever it encounters them. And it feels good about itself because it can't take a joke and doesn't understand the satirical point that I was making in a novel that was slightly edgy and sexist. And I wonder whether you have thoughts about this disparity between our kind of public fixation on doing the right thing as it is defined by the current cultural consensus and turning a blind eye to the actual ills that corporations are unleashing on us.
Oh, yeah. No, I cover that in Puff Piece where... Like one of the internal journeys I go on is at the start of the book, and this was all sincere. I was like, oh, everyone's going to get the groove of this book. It's sort of, isn't it? It's a thing. Like people would see me as progressive, I guess. And and so people, it's like, oh, and your little David going against Goliath or whatever. And then I kind of, it kind of, I learn that that's a bit of a bygone era. That's like a Generation X thing. The whole thing of corporations are something you should be very skeptical of is like that was when I was young, that was it. But sort of like the backdrop to the world has moved on. And obviously all these things, like I kind of have to overstate my case to sort of make my point. Obviously, you know, there's so many little currents and countercurrents floating around. So in some ways, you know, there are progressive people who are criticizing corporations or whatever. So I'm sort of, but in a kind of a larger sense, I think part of the reason is, I mean, you sort of touch on it there, I think, or whatever, is that for my generation, Generation X, when we were growing up, like corporations were just seen as, in this overgeneralized way, were seen as unprogressive. They were seen as right wing, I guess, even. And they were seen as even sort of like a bit sort of like Christian, maybe, or something like I was seen as this. They were sort of like seen as that. And it was like, even if you're a good company, you were a bad company. And so,
well, they were part of an institutional power structure that was avaricious and only interested in itself and was willing to fuck over anybody, just like,
and also and generally generally their values were like the way they promoted themselves was even if it was implicit rather than explicit, was very conservative values. So like ads on TV would show traditional nuclear families, for instance. They would and they were conservative outlets in how they presented themselves.
Well, their center of gravity was
the way they presented themselves were like family values and patriotic and things like that. And so it would have been like totally contentious to not present yourself that way. Anyway, but the backdrop to the world has changed. So now the way that the world's biggest companies present themselves aren't that way. For whatever reason, and for better maybe, but regardless. So yeah, you have like Google and Apple, and they're like these big powerful companies, and they will, you know, promote kind of like have a progressive veneer, and it must have worked to a certain extent, because I feel like compared to when I was growing up, progressive aren't as instantly kind of like cynical and about companies like they were. And I think it is partially because like it's worked. It's like, why would you be cynical about companies when companies, you know, are fighting are fighting the good fight, which I guess they are in some ways, but
they're not fighting it if they're not putting the good fight to anywhere where it actually needs to be put, you know, as per my analogy true. About
but LGBT, I guess the way I look at that is that's why you should be skeptical for your own sense of personal zen, because you're just going to be so disappointed.
Be surprised by being disappointed? That's what amazes me. It's that people are surprised that corporations are only looking after their bottom line. Like, why would you applaud a company for firing a satirist for writing a funny passage as if that's noble of the company to stand up against sexism? Like, I think everybody at Apple and Facebook now is on board that racism is bad and sexism is bad. Like, we get that. Why would you be such a rube that you would be gullible enough to think that the executives are feeding you the manure that they're feeding you because they really, really care about these issues? That's what I don't get. There's a certain credulity sort of in modern performative progressivism.
I guess it's also, it's really hard to get your bearings on what's online in a bubble and what's the wider world thinking, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think it's vastly blown up. I think the things that are taking place online are now having real world consequences that far outstrip their popularity amongst real people. We're all being run
by the Supermarket. Yeah, but what I'm saying is, it's like, I imagine people, it might be a bit simpler why people go along with things. It's like just the path of least resistance. And it's, you know, so, but it is interesting, because as an artiste who puts myself out there, like, you do really have to think about, like, well, what's the hill I'm meant to die on? What hill am I meant to die on? And that's, like, way narrower, even for someone like me. But I guess I was always a bit contained in what, like, I, like for instance, I just, like, for instance, wouldn't be like, I'd find it really hard, even like Yonks, even do like partisan politics or something like that. Like, it just wasn't my jam. It's like, no, that's okay for someone else to do, but I'm actually more interested in your religion, or I'm interested in these other hypocrisies or whatever like that. So, but yeah, you definitely recalibrate. And it's like, well, what's the hill I'm willing to die on? And so there still are some hills I'm willing to die on. And
What are those hills you're willing to die on?
Oh, just I'm not willing to go along with anti-Semitism just because certain people have figured out a woke framing for it. So I'm just not willing to go along with it. And I've even got in trouble for that because I'm just meant to go along with it. I'm meant to go along with and I just feel a personal responsibility because in the context of Australia, there might be a lot of Jews blabbering in America in the media, but not in Australia. And so I just feel like I can't. First of all, it's annoying. And then on top of that, I just feel like, who am I? And also, I just feel like I have a responsibility.
What do you mean by anti-Semitism? Where does that show up in your world?
So the two places it shows up on is if you're very clever and you don't like Jews, you recast them as not being Jews, but as being white people. And then you act really cute and as if there's no particular history to Jewish people and there's no particular heat to attacking Jews. And you're just, you're almost just framing it as well. No, that's not the I'm kind of dodging around giving examples in the world,
it would clarify things.
Yeah, sure. So, for instance, I was told I actually covered this in Puff Piece, believe it or not. And so, why don't I just tell the story in Puff Piece? So, I was at this anti-Nazi rally in Melbourne, and this person, like a lefty social justice type, was writing about me, and he said, anti-racism doesn't need any more white people to speak on its behalf. So they had problematized, to use their language, me as a Jew being at an anti-Nazi rally. So I was like, oh, that's a bit strange or whatever. And at the same rally, there was like a similar thing. So like these two things that were kind of similar happened. Anyway, when I get back home, I'm like looking at this guy's, I'm going, who's this guy telling me like, that it's problematic for a Jew to fight Nazis. And then I look up and I see he's got a track record of, for better or worse, of like he's got issues with Jewish people, like, and for all sorts of reasons, like he's against Israel. And let's not get into that or whatever, because it's not about whether he's right or whatever. It's more about the technique he's using. And he's he's just had these other kind of issues with Jewish people. And I was going, oh, that's interesting. So, because there's still a bit of heat in attacking Jews, it's like he's reframed Jews as white people to sort of make that a smoother passage. Because obviously, if he said, what's this Jew doing here at this rally?
Yeah.
It'd just be, what the hell? And anyway, so that happened. And then I noticed that was this recurring technique of across the world now of when you had held pretty toxic view. Assuming you weren't right wing, if you're like left wing, or if you were like a Muslim or whatever, like you're very attuned to how to get things done in the modern world, is you erase the fact that Jews are Jews and just act really cute and just call them white people, and then think you can get away with anything because it's like, oh, I'm punching up. Or that kind of thing.
They're colonizers too. So, you know, you mentioned Israel, but I've definitely heard a lot of that. I was a very prominent Australian radio personality. I was with this person, and some news came through about Israel firing on people in Gaza or something, and this person spat out with such vitriol, "Fucking Zionists," with a passion I felt bad for the people in Gaza as well, and I have all of my own issues with Israel. But that's not the point. The point is that country's misdeeds have become a proxy for people to feel passionately against there's been a collapse or a conflation of one really problematic country's really problematic policies with the kind of instinctive punching up, fighting on behalf of the little guy, anti-colonial, anti-Zionist, and now anti-Jew.
But I mean, obviously, there's like such a complex thing to get into. So, the two things I'd say is that, yeah, it's complicated. And so I'm not really like, I'm not going as narrow as that as saying, oh my God, it's all a trick. If someone's criticizing the Israeli government, it's actually a proxy for whatever. So what I am saying is, yeah, it's complicated, but then I'd add the extra layer of like, everything's complicated and somehow the left manages not to, the left manages not to kind of conflate. And in fact, they fight against it correctly. You know, they correctly, like if anyone from another minority's involved in anything, they go, whoa, hold our horses, right? Okay, so this bad thing happened. This person,
you mean,
blew
if there's
up,
a,
so,
if there's like a jihadist terrorist attack, then they're quite
yeah,
good
but
at not
no,
conflating
no, that,
that
and,
with
yeah,
the
yeah, yeah,
yeah,
or anything with any minority or whatever, because they correctly kind of go, well, let's hold our horses or whatever, so it's not novel, or it's not like unusual that it's like, oh my God, I just can't not be an anti-Semite because there's this going on. And
but I don't my point
being is that in fact that what you said about the Jews in Israel makes it even more so for me that if you're on the left, or if you're in a Muslim, let's just talk about Australia. If you're Australian Muslim or Australian on the left, the fact that you have such heated issues about Jews being in Israel, that makes it even the more screwed up if you try that on in another country that's not Israel. No, you don't get to kind of go, well, oh, Jews are just white, so therefore they're also a problem in Australia as white. Like that's got a lot of you can't erase the specific nature and the specific history of the Jews, and also the specific relationship that both the left and the Muslims communities can have with you. You can't erase that and just kind of go, oh, I'm just going to shit on Jews and I'm going to change the word Jew to white and therefore get away with it. I mean, if you think this is tangled and complicated, probably the best way to, I can say it, that maybe a lefty listening could understand is, like, imagine if someone was said to some Aboriginal people in Australia that were of fairer skin and said, well, no, you're just white. I'm just going to treat you, and my discussion about you and your place in Australia and in the world is going to be through the lens of you. I know you think this Aboriginal stuff is important or whatever, but no, you're white. Like, a lefty would never do, not only would not a lefty do that, but like Andrew Bolt, this arch conservative in Australia who the left hates, the main reason they hate him, the starting point, is that was his argument. You know what I mean? So what I'm saying is, my contention is, and I'm is you the specific history, including the specific recent history of Jewish people, is so specific. It's as specific as Aboriginality in a different way, that it's just screwed up to the extreme. It's as screwed up to the extreme to evaporate and erase Jewish identity, but you're just white, and God, you know, that's as screwed up as saying that to a fair-skinned Aboriginal person, which I know that's a very I don't think that's contentious at all, and so therefore, so that's an aspect of like where I just refuse to like keep my head down.
Well, it's
because
also
things like, do you know something that happened recently in Melbourne is that an Australian business run by a Jewish guy was vandalized by presumed left-wing people, where it was said that, oh, he's part of an international Zionist conspiracy because whatever. So, and the left says, it's so weird being a Jew, even in Australia, because if it gets, this is how weird it is and how specific it is if neo-Nazis did exactly the same thing, put exactly the same posters up accusing a local Jew of being part of an international Zionist conspiracy, then the left would all stand up for him and go, my God, we've got this neo-Nazi problem in Australia. But then you can put up exactly the same posters from the left. And so this isn't like a thought experiment. This happened in my hometown. And and then this leading left-wing journal published an article explaining why vandalizing a Jewish business, and of course they fudged around the language a bit, is not problematic for this. And I'm just like, nah, not going along with that. I don't care. And also, I kind of also find, I try to take advantage of the fact that I have a bit of capital because I've got a track record. And so people are a bit, I do get away with a bit more, get a bit more pushing back or whatever, because, and I, it's like, yep, I'm going to, I'll push back against that. No, I'm not going to go along with it's okay to harass Jewish shop owners in my hometown.
Yeah.
And I have paid for that, by the way, but where people are just really, people did not like you bringing up. I did my last book about extremists in Australia. Like 95% of the book is shtick, making fun of the far right and their Islamophobia, for instance, right? But also it looked into the tangles of things. And so I talk about, because it's fascinating, I talk about like Jewish people who kind of make these unwise, you know, connections with the far right, because they're like, oh, well, I don't like Muslims and they don't like Muslims. So even though they also don't, even though they don't, they also don't like Jews, I'm going to link up with them. So it's kind of,
trust me, Adolf does not have your back.
Yeah. And then my book also looked at the changing backdrop where like the Pauline Hanson scene has adapted to multiculturalism. So just bizarrely, you have people who would have been rejected by the Pauline Hanson crowd 20 years ago, suddenly for, you know, you've got, you know, you've got African Australians and Chinese Australians and others that sort of involved in that movement. Often, sometimes the reason for that is because they're evangelical Christians and they don't like Muslims. And they're like, oh, well, Pauline Hanson also doesn't like Muslims. Let's join up or whatever. So, anyway, so my book also did shtick about that or whatever. And then my book did look at Muslim anti-Semitism in Australia, like, and just very lightly, very in a very coded way or whatever like that. People do not like that. Like people do not like that, and I've paid where, like, just the most like people out for vengeance. It's like, and I'm just like, well, okay, fine, go out for vengeance, I don't care.
Well, there are the sort of right kind of minorities and the wrong kind of minorities, and there is a sense, I think, that you're backing the wrong horse if you're backing Jews, and you're backing the right horse in terms of backing the correct oppressed minority if you're backing Muslims.
That's fine for them to think. I cannot believe.
Let me just finish this, because it reminds me of what you were saying earlier, John, about the lack of self-awareness of Americans imposing their culture war conversations on the rest of the world, or having no sort of self-regard for their own privileged status in guiding the global conversation. And similarly, there's a way that we are forced to understand Israel and Palestine that sort of uses the Jews as a proxy for all of the sins of white people over the centuries, because they are the colonizers and the poor brown people are the oppressed. And that maps perfectly. It's sort of a key into the lock of our own collective guilt about what we've done to Indigenous people and what we've done through British colonialism and so on. And I think there's a parallel there, that there's a similar kind of superimposition of a complicated situation in the Middle East onto an easy template that we understand, in which the Jews are the aggressors, and it kind of flattens or ignores or erases the 5,000 years of history. And so all of a sudden this community that has very, very, very long ties in this place is regarded as if it was the British Empire coming into India.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jesus, like, you bring up
I've only got 5 or 10 minutes left. So take that wherever you will. And if you want to say something else.
Oh, no. Well, first of all, from my point of view, I started getting really furious with, or animated by left-wing attitudes to Jews, not because of Israel, because I went along with their reality, where they said, because they'd assure us, they said, oh, there's nothing everything about the Jews that we have a problem with is just got to do with the Israel-Palestine conflict, right? So I was like, oh, that's like a complicated conflict or whatever, but, you know, like, you know, okay, fine, you know. Kind of definitely like, it's not like I think someone's mad if they're kind of, their interpretation of that is, you know, they're going to have a, they're going to protest or, you know, have issues and bring up things about the Israeli government or whatever, right? But then it was when there was the gear shift, and it was when I was doing my last book where I realized it's bullshit that they, like, for instance, this dude who's deliberately acting cute and obtuse and saying that it's problematic for Jews to be, not only for Jews to be wherever they want to be in Melbourne, but specifically having such a toxic attitude to Jewish people that he's come up with this tangled bullshit that it's problematic for a Jew to be at an anti-Nazi rally protesting Nazis because he's white. And then when I kind of go online and see that this guy, oh, by the way, he's gone on to be a writer who writes about racism for SBS, by the way. And these people I'm talking about, they're not like randoms on Twitter. Cultural tastemakers. So, and when I saw that he was using Jewish whiteness to attack Jews, not in Israel, so Jewish whiteness to attack Jews in Australia, I was like, well, hang on. And then when I saw that he was reflecting a broader thing among some aspects of the hard left, I was like, oh, so you were lying. So you were lying that whole time saying your problem with the Jews was about the Israel-Palestine thing, because now you've got this new thing where Jews are a problem outside of Israel for things that have nothing to do with the Israel-Palestine conflict. So I was like really annoyed. And then kind of like anti-Semitism is so slippery, but only in a way that all racism is. So like to give you a comparison, you know, like when a black person says, hey, I was followed, you know, through a shopping center because I'm black or whatever. And people are like, approve it. How do you know they didn't follow a white person before you? And then it's like, well, I guess how can you or whatever? And then it's like, but the black person would be going, listen, man, it's happened 50 times. So I know what the hell is going on. And like, so anti-Semitism is like that, is that like, it's so slippery and scummy. For instance, what's wrong with this guy saying it's problematic for you as a white person to be at an anti-Nazi rally? Like, it's so slippery and scumbaggery, and it's really the parallels there. And people will find that contentious that I'm comparing those racisms, but I think in their slipperiness and the way that it's the same sense. Thing.
I mean, because I think it makes sense.
One thing I've really learned is because people like present their anti-Semitism like in a woke way, like, oh, it's because you're white. God knows. And it's always like this woke argument on things. But okay, fine. But this is what, when you pull out the lens, is that most racist rhetoric is woke. Is pitching itself as woke. Like when I was hanging out with these far right racists against Muslims, they all frame their anti-Islam in woke language. They say, oh, listen, they're sexist. We're in a modern culture and they're sexist. They put women in burqas. Like it's that's not just against racism against Muslims. It's when they were lynching black Americans. I'd wrote a book called Murder in Mississippi, set in Mississippi. There was a nonfiction about true crime and it involved the white supremacists. So I got to look into the history of Mississippi, and lynchings were pitched as woke back in the old days. They really were. It was like women shouldn't have to suffer being sexually harassed by black men, and these black people are sexually harassing women at a higher rate. Like, this is bullshit, by the way. But what I'm saying is they were pitching lynching as being woke, as being feminine, as lynchings were hashtag believe all women. And so all racism, racist rhetoric, bends into like, I'm doing this for a social justice reason. I'm forced to be against Muslims in Australia and to want to stop Muslim immigration because I care so much about burkas or like women not being, or even saying I care so much about Jews and I know they're racist against Jews, or I care so much about they throw gay people off buildings.
Well, exactly,
or,
that's like, what I was going to say. That you homophobic pastors being Islamophobic because they're supposedly sticking up for the gays being thrown off buildings.
Yeah.
By
so with that backdrop, it's like, yeah, I get it. You're doing what all assholes do when they try to demonize the other, and
it's very interesting, John. You're what do you think, where do you think all this goes, where do you think we end up with all this, not specifically the anti-Semitism question, but all of the roiling culture war tensions that we have been talking about? Because on some days I wake up optimistic and I think, as you sort of alluded to earlier, that this is just a storm in a teacup on Twitter and I should just shut down my Twitter and I'll be a happier person. And then other times I think that the fabric of liberal democracy and the consensus that we've established since the Enlightenment is coming apart and we're all just going to end up in
I've no answer to that, but I have an answer to that. So my answer to that is that we're never at the end of history. And at every moment, we always think that this is the world forever. And it never is. I mean, I don't know how old you are, but like just the realities of the world that have changed in my lifetime is like the gear shifts have been incredible. And so I find it very difficult to believe that we're at the end of history and with the way the world is perceived. Man.
All right. On that note, full of foreboding and portent, yes. I will crown you as the loveliest Jewess in Australia. And thank you, John. The new book, shill the new book for a moment, so people can jump on to
Puff Piece. And by the way, it's really hilarious. Amazon. Puff Piece. It's like a hilarious adventure. It's not like this. It's me kind of getting into deep, trying to. Discover all this stuff about Philip Morris, the Marlboro people. It's called Puff Piece, How Philip Morris Set Vaping Alike Light and Burnt Down the English Language. But, just Puff Piece, that's the big thing on the cover.
Good
it's
on
hilarious.
You, John. You're
hilarious.
A national treasure.
Audio book.
Thanks for being with us. Great to talk to you. Thanks, mate.
Bye-bye.